The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Thomas M. Harris presiding.
Good afternoon. This is the last case of the day. It's case number 4-22-0887, People versus Raymond Mowry. Could we have appearances, please? First for the appellant.
Ryan Wilson for Raymond Mowry, the appellant.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
First name Allison Page, last name Brooks, on behalf of the people.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wilson, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Wilson, and I represent Raymond Mowry on behalf of the Office of the State Appellate Defender. I plan to focus my argument on issue one of the opening brief today and also on the argument raised in the supplemental brief. Certainly, if this court has questions regarding any of the other arguments, I'm happy to answer those. In Beck versus Ohio, the U.S. Supreme Court cautioned against simply relying upon the good faith of police officers when it comes to the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. It follows then that a police officer must have reasonable and articulable suspicion of an offense in order to effectuate a traffic stop. And in People versus Haddad, a case very similar to the one that we're discussing today, it involved a claim of the defendant following too closely. The court stated, when judging the reasonableness of a traffic stop, courts must apply an objective standard and scrutinize whether the facts available to the officer at the time of the stop would warrant a reasonable person to believe that the traffic stop was appropriate. Essentially, these cases demonstrate that an officer's belief, the reason for a stop, can be challenged by a defendant. And that's exactly what defense counsel was trying to do here. Mr. Mowry was stopped off of the interstate for allegedly following a vehicle too closely. And there's a statute that applies in such a case. It prohibits a vehicle from following another more closely than is reasonable and prudent, having due regard for the speed of each vehicle, the traffic, and the highway. There was a motion to suppress filed in this case challenging the traffic stop. And during a hearing on that motion, the officer who stopped the defendant explained that he thought that a following distance of 5 to 6 car lengths would be appropriate. And fortunately, we have an important piece of evidence here. We have the officer's dash cam. It provides a recording, an objective view of what actually happened in the instant case. And it demonstrates that when the officer pursued Mr. Mowry and finally pulled him over, he told Mr. Mowry that he was stopping the defendant because when he passed the officer who was sitting in the median, Mr. Mowry was approximately one car length behind a semi and did not maintain a safe following distance once the officer began his pursuit. Defense counsel, however, did something that even the circuit court thought was kind of unique. He took the officer's dash camera and sent it to a videographer who was able to determine exactly how far Mr. Mowry was from the semi at various points.
Mr. Wilson, can I
Yes.
just ask a question in this regard? In terms of where the video first starts, can you tell us when it starts in relation to where defendant's vehicle was relative to the trooper's vehicle?
If I understand your question correctly, Justice Harris, the video starts before the semi-truck that Mr. Mowry was allegedly following appears on the screen. The semi-truck appears on the screen. Mr. Mowry's vehicle is then visible following the semi-truck at some distance. The officer, when he stopped...
Can I stop you again? I just want to know, the trooper's vehicle is in the median, right?
Correct.
The traffic's going southbound. Semi passes, and then the defendant's vehicle passes, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Is that captured on video? When the vehicles pass the trooper's location?
It is. And in fact, Justice Harris, in the appendix to the opening brief, I have added not only screenshots of that very point that you're speaking about right now, but also the demonstrative exhibits that defense counsel put together demonstrating the distance that Mr. Morey was following the semi at that point.
Okay, thank you.
So when the trooper, Hefner DeWitt, approached Mr. Morey's car after stopping him, he told Mr. Morey that the traffic stop was necessary because Mr. Morey was approximately a car length behind a semi when they passed Trooper DeWitt, Hefner DeWitt, who was sitting in the median. He also said that when Hefner DeWitt was pursuing Mr. Morey, he did not maintain a safe distance from the semi. As I just discussed with Justice Harris, I attached some demonstrative exhibits the counsel admitted in this case. And those exhibits demonstrate that at the time that Mr. Morey passed Trooper Hefner DeWitt in the median, he was approximately 9 car lengths behind the semi. Now, this is far more distant than Trooper Hefner DeWitt initially said of 1 car length behind the semi, and it is far in excess of what Trooper Hefner DeWitt testified to as far as a safe following distance of 5 to 6 car lengths. We're fortunate to have the video in this case because it does give that objective view of what happened in this case and serves as a check on Hefner DeWitt's testimony regarding when he saw the infraction in this case. During the hearing on the motion to suppress, and for the first time, Hefner DeWitt added that there was an entirely different point when he believed that Mr. Morey was following the semi too closely. And that was when he first saw Mr. Morey's car. The state has cited to that to say that there's nothing wrong with what happened here and that the motion to suppress was properly denied. The problem with that argument is it assumes a few things. We have the dash cam video of Trooper Hefner DeWitt's discussion with Mr. Morey, and in that video, he says nothing about seeing Mr. Morey following too closely down the interstate when he
Was he
first.
required to say that?
He wasn't required to say that, but I think it goes to his credibility. Certainly, if
Is
this
that the
was.
trial judge's call, whether it goes to his credibility or not?
It is. Although credibility is something that this court can also look at and can also weigh. And
So we should second guess the trial judge's determination that the trooper was credible?
where there is demonstrative evidence that provides an objective view of what happened here that is so inconsistent with what the trooper testified to, I don't believe that that would be inappropriate. You have the trooper saying that when Mr. Morey passed him in the median, Mr. Morey was approximately a car length behind the semi, and we have videotape evidence that is a reliable neutral observer to what happened here, demonstrating that Mr. Morey was in fact far, much farther behind the semi than that, approximately
Why
nine
isn't
car
the
lengths.
question whether, given the speed and the presence of the truck and the defendant's car, whether he was traveling too closely, and the question whether the officer had probable cause to believe or reasonable grounds to suspect that that offense had been committed?
It roughly is. The problem is, in this case, the officer gave us a matrix for when that offense occurs. And the officer said it would be if he was following in had a following distance of 5 to 6 car lengths, that would be reasonable under the circumstances. Here, this objective evidence shows that Mr. Morey was far further behind the semi than what the officer said would be appropriate. It demonstrates that Mr. Morey was indeed driving appropriate.
Isn't the evidence presented by defense counsel better attuned to a defense that the state can prove the charge beyond a reasonable doubt, as opposed to whether or not the officer had reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle?
I don't believe so. And that goes back to this Haddad case that I cited at the outset of my argument, another case that discussed an offense of following too closely, where the court said, and I won't read the quote again, but essentially that given the circumstances, the stop would have to be appropriate as viewed by a reasonable person. And while Hefner DeWitt did testify regarding the stop in this case, it is not something that can be overlooked, that he didn't testify accurately. And we know that because we have the video. It is that neutral observer to what happened here that isn't subject to manipulation or mistake, like seemingly Trooper Hefner DeWitt's testimony was. And that's
what you've handled lots of cases. Have you ever seen a hearing on a motion to suppress where the defense presented the kind of evidence and detailed analysis the defense attorney, Mr. Morris, presented in this case?
I have not.
Should we find it at all curious that nonetheless, one of the issues on appeal here is whether or not Morris provided ineffective assistance of counsel, at least as far as your client wishes the matter to have been argued?
Well, and it all depends on the extent of the ineffectiveness. Counsel can properly litigate a motion to suppress and then make a trial error or an error for failing to, for example, call a witness during the suppression proceedings that still demonstrates that he was ineffective. The fact that counsel does something right and goes the extra mile doesn't necessarily mean that there's no ineffectiveness here. And incidentally, and I'm hopping ahead a little bit, but incidentally, this was one thing that this court looked at during the earlier appeal. This was a case where Mr. Morey made a Krenkel claim. This court viewed that Krenkel claim and with the state's concession, found that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file an additional motion to suppress. That motion to suppress was filed beyond the time limit that the court had given defense counsel to file that motion. And during an initial preliminary Krenkel inquiry, Mr. Morris said, essentially, yeah, that's my fault. I should have done that. He had all of the information. If counsel litigates one part of a motion to suppress correctly, and then completely drops the ball on another part of the motion to suppress that could end the case altogether, I would say that that's ineffective. So I have no problem with, on one hand, saying that Mr. Morris did an admirable job of getting this evidence on Mr. Morris' behalf, and also acknowledging what Mr. Morris himself has acknowledged.
Before time's up, I have two other matters I want to ask you about. The defendant in this case was convicted of violating Section 10401 ATC of the Controlled Substances Act. Says it's a Class 6 felony when the defendant possesses more than 400 grams of a controlled substance. The trial court noted that the defendant possessed 500 grams of cocaine when he was arrested, 100 grams more than the minimum amount prescribed by the statute. Why isn't that a factor which the court can take into consideration in imposing a sentence as opposed to just the 400 grams? Why isn't the increased 100 grams a factor which the court can say this is bad or worse, etc.?
The statute that you cite is part of kind of an accelerated sentencing scheme for different quantities of a controlled substance. Mr. Morey was convicted of possessing between 400 and 899 grams of cocaine. It is inferred that the legislature thinks about things like the harm to the community when they're passing legislation and implementing a sentencing range. And where an offense says that the defendant shall be sentenced to, I believe it's 12 to 50 years for the specific offense for the possession of cocaine in the amount of 400 to 899 grams. We presume that the legislature has already thought about that harm to society when they pass that sentencing range. And so the judge's consideration of that factor for a second time after the legislature had already considered the harm to society renders it a factor that the court can't consider again. The legislature has already done that by implementing the increased sentencing range.
So your argument is that it's improper for the court to consider when imposing the sentence that it was 500 grams of cocaine as opposed to 400?
When it comes to the harm that controlled substance poses to the community, yes. The legislature, again, has already determined that when they set the sentencing range. And the court then should not be considering that for a second time and increasing the punishment.
So this court has repeatedly suggested, starting with at least the Hibbler case, that when we're getting an argument that the court has considered a factor inherent in the offense, that the first question, first point to consider is, what's the minimum conduct necessary to commit the offense? And here it's 400 grams, and we made it clear in a bunch of cases that where it exceeds that, for instance, it might be an aggravated battery to cause great bodily harm and knock someone down and break his jaw, but if the defendant then proceeds to stomp on his head multiple times, that's more than is required for the minimum to have the offense occur. Why doesn't that same analysis apply here?
And I'm wondering if maybe we're talking about two different things, and that may be the issue. My problem with the court's sentencing decision in this case is that the court tied it to the harm that the drugs caused to society. When she used that, the judge used that as an aggravating factor. That harm to society.
Well, wait a minute. Aren't you primarily arguing that the court considered a factor inherent in the offense? Wasn't that your primary argument?
Yes, that is the primary argument. And the cases say that the legislature, when they pass a sentencing range, they consider themselves the danger that's inherent to the public. And that's what I'm arguing the judge can't consider again. The judge can't say, oh, you had 500 grams of cocaine. This is really bad for the community.
Well, why isn't it the same thing as the aggravated battery argument? He broke his jaw and he hit him. Therefore, the fact that he stomped his head repeatedly after that can't be considered by the court imposing sentence. Isn't that your same argument?
It's not, because I think in your hypothetical, there's actually a manifestation that the court can rely on to show that the punishment should be increased. I think my argument would be much more difficult to make if it were a situation where, when officers found Mr. Morey, he had 500 little gram baggies of the cocaine, showing that he wanted to distribute it to every single person that he possibly could. That's not the fact we have here. We don't have anything showing that his 500 grams of cocaine are inherently any more dangerous than the 400 grams that the legislature had as a base, or are any different than the 899 grams that the legislature made as a maximum for this offense.
One of the other things I want to ask you about before your time is up is your reliance on the Second District's decision in Downs.
Yes, Your Honor.
Both for the proposition that counsel is duty bound to assert all non-frivolous arguments that the defendant wants him to assert, Krenkel counsel. As you know, we're not bound to follow Downs. And my question is, do you know of any other instance where the standards for ineffective assistance of counsel set forth in Strickland don't apply except for what the Second District said in Downs?
I don't know of a situation like what you're mentioning, other than the cases that are following Downs.
But there's only one other Second District case, I believe, Kyles. So Downs and Kyles, wouldn't they be correctly deemed the aberrational cases that don't follow Strickland versus Washington and its progeny? In every other case, in every other situation, isn't that the standard to be followed on asking the question, was counsel ineffective?
I don't believe so. And I've got a couple of reasons for that. Downs was decided about 7.5 years ago. That case was also a petition for leave to appeal was filed with the Illinois Supreme Court, and it was denied. There have been numerous cases that have cited to Downs since that time. And incidentally, as a matter of candor to the court and to opposing counsel, I just want to note that as I was preparing for this argument today, I noted that in my supplemental reply brief, I cited to a 2018 unpublished Rule 23 order by accident. That was completely unintentional, and I understand that that's not persuasive authority at all. I apologize to the court for that. But that aside, there have been numerous cases that have sided to Downs approvingly. And where Downs, I think, becomes very important is the realization that oftentimes you have counsel that is stepping in many times to a very difficult case, like Mr. Morey's, for example, and they're having to take up his mantle. This isn't like a case of guilty plea proceedings, for example, where there's some certification that counsel files saying, I've read all the transcripts, I've researched this case fully, I've talked to the defendant, I've raised all of his claims. There is no requisite showing in this case demonstrating that counsel did all of the things that he was supposed to do. And so I think it follows that counsel who's appointed to represent a defendant during a Krankel evidentiary hearing isn't acting as an advocate for the state or the court. That attorney is acting as an advocate for the defendant. And it may be difficult for that advocate to look at the defendant's claims in detail and affirmatively figure out what claims have merit and what claims don't. Now, certainly the advocate shouldn't be raising claims that are frivolous. That's one of the guardrails that is present here. But the court has said in Downs and in Kyles that it is incumbent upon defense counsel to raise any claim that is colorable on the defendant's behalf and let the court decide whether that claim is actually meritorious, to act as an advocate for the defendant. And I think that's completely appropriate in a situation where counsel oftentimes is stepping into a large case and having to figure out what issues to raise on the defendant's behalf.
Mr. Wilson,
Additionally,
you are out of time.
oh, I'm
Justice
sorry, Rob.
Steigman, Justice
That's all right.
Steigman, do you have any follow-up for
I
that?
did not. Thank you.
Okay,
Thank you,
thank you.
Rob.
Ms. Brooks, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. With respect to the lawfulness of the stop, if I try to distill what appears to be the defendant's claim, is that because one of the angles, I guess, on the dash cam video, which was analyzed by a defendant's videographer, appears to show the cars at a wider distance than the defendant's vehicle in the truck that he was behind, at a wider distance than the infraction witnessed by the officer, which occurred prior to the defendant's car getting towards the officer's spot in the median, that affects the officer's credibility. And therefore, essentially, that the trial court's findings, I guess, are all against the manifest weight of the evidence. And the state believes, though, is according to the defendant's, I'm sorry, the trial court's finding that the officer testified very credibly. And of course, the what was appeared on the video itself is not going to rebut what the officer saw with his own eyes prior to the point where the car gets passing the officer in the median. So therefore, when the officer says that that was a couple car lengths maybe, but not even a car length and a half behind a semi, and that's an infraction that was witnessed by the officer's own eyes, not on the video, but in the officer's own view, prior to the defendant and the truck reaching the officer's position, the median. And if the officer testified very credibly, according to the trial court, that's the type of thing that this court, it would be very difficult for a reviewing court to overrule a trial court's credibility determination. That's one of the hardest things to do for as a party who is appealing a trial court's credibility determination. And here, because the video doesn't measure the car lengths at the time of the actual infraction, and I understand the defense making a point that, well, the officer told the defendant something differently, like about the infraction occurring at the time they passed the car, passed the officer's position, but that would go only to sort of rebut in some small way the officer's credibility. It could have just been what the officer chose to tell the defendant, not actually what the officer witnessed. So it doesn't necessarily mean the officer's lying about witnessing the defendant's car only like a car length and a half behind a semi truck, which is it's unreasonable to follow a semi so closely. I mean, people have been decapitated by semi trucks going their cars underneath the trailer, for example. It's very important to maintain a safe distance when following at highway speeds. If a truck has to very quickly decelerate, you don't want to be like only a car length and a half behind a semi trailer. So that this is a type of it's a very reasonable thing for the officer to witness this traffic violation and to make a stop to issue a warning for this. So therefore, it's not a situation where the officer is making some sort of unreasonable, objectively unreasonable mistake in what they're seeing. What they saw was objectively reasonable and credible, and the record is insufficient to overrule those determinations. And so, also, I think the prosecutor argued that basically what was apparent on the video was that the defendant appeared to be slowing down, which is a reasonable thing for people to do as they approach an officer in the median, particularly if they're hauling a half a, 500 grams of, or half a kilo of cocaine in their car. You're not going to want to get pulled over for speeding. So, if you see an officer in the median, you're probably going to pump the brakes. And so, therefore, if the falling too closely infraction is before the officer, the defendant gets to the officer's position in the median. And if the defendant, it's inferred, sees the officer in the median, knowing he's got a half a kilo of cocaine in his car, is going to want to slow down. So that's going to create more distance between the defendant and the truck by the time they actually reach the officer's position. So that argument, I think, also would support the idea that there's this discrepancy the defendant is trying to identify between the infraction itself, which happened before the defendant reaches the officer's position, and what was apparent on the camera in front of the officer as as the defendant goes by. If that's a widening gap because as it should be apparent on the video, the defendant is actually slowing down relative to the truck and therefore is gaining more distance between the two vehicles. So for that reason, the defendant's motion to suppress was properly denied. And with respect to the issue on Downs, well, I'm not sure exactly if the claim is the defendant is not getting his Sixth Amendment right to counsel under Strickland, or if he's violating some sort of like Illinois common law Krankel rule. If Downs is sort of expounded on a common law rule under Krankel, see the supreme law of the land is the Sixth Amendment, the U.S. Constitution, and any Illinois common law rule that violates that Sixth Amendment right of a defendant's ability to receive effective counsel. And because under Strickland, there is the constitutionally protected right of independence of counsel. And as has been recognized since time beyond memory, one of the most effective things a counsel can do is winnow out losing and poor arguments. And a standard that would require a attorney who, in a critical stage, defendant has a right to effective assistance of counsel, to handcuff them and force them to present as many as barely non-frivolous, potentially numerous claims, and present those on the defendant's behalf is taking away a lot of the experience and skill that an attorney would have in terms of focusing their limited time in court on the strongest arguments that might have the best chances of winning.
Ms.
And
Brooks, in advance of
yes.
this argument, have you formulated any worst-case scenarios that you can imagine that would put defense counsel in a bad position, or excuse me, that would put the defendant in a bad position, Sixth Amendment-wise, if counsel had to present to the court all non-frivolous claims? Can you just give us a for example?
Well, I mean, it could be like 40 barely non-frivolous claims. I mean, something that is non-frivolous could be something that's still completely foreclosed by existing law, but it would just require the attorney to make a argument for the good faith argument for the reversal of existing law. So the Illinois Supreme Court could have come out like last year and said that this argument is a loser. But if as long as you have a good faith basis to say that, well, that should be reversed, maybe the U.S. Supreme Court might reverse it or something. To have to take up issues like that, sure losers. I mean, an attorney's experience, there's no reason to waste limited court time and their own efforts, their own limited time, particularly if it's an appointed attorney who may have limited resources due to the demands of many other cases. To expend these sort of limited resources in court time and their own ability to do their own job with heavy caseloads, for example, it's just the type of ruling that actually hurts defendants. That's why I don't understand that a rule that would take away the constitutionally guaranteed independence of counsel should be something the defense bar should be would definitely com should be complaining about here, because the Sixth Amendment says that this is something that you can't create strict rules that limit how an attorney can do their job, as
Is
is
there
also
any
done.
room, any leeway to read Downs as saying counsel doesn't have to include all non-frivolous claims? Or do you think that the Downs essentially stands for that proposition that Krankel counsel has to include all non-frivolous claims that the pro se defendant has raised?
That's how I read it, is that regardless of the lack of likelihood of potentially winning, I mean, something can be non-frivolous. It doesn't mean it has any chance of winning, and it's a waste of time and resources to try to pursue many non-frivolous claims, particularly when doing so might harm the defendant, because here it's trying to give the defense the ability to use their own skill and experience in arguing the best case possible to get their client the relief they want. And hamstringing them by requiring them to make any non-frivolous claim is actually hurting defendants. And that's why I guess this sort of rule is, I see it more as like an extension of a common law Krankel doctrine, not like an actual Sixth Amendment requirement, because it's not a Sixth Amendment requirement. It actually is against the Sixth Amendment's independence of counsel. So that's why I guess if it is treated as an extension of the common law Krankel doctrine for just purposes of Illinois law only, but this is actually incongruous with the Sixth Amendment, and that's why it should not be followed.
Brooks, I have a question about Downs and Kyles. It's my understanding that those are the only two opinions from the Second District which hold what Downs said, which I think you've correctly described, and Kyles, which followed it. Are there some other opinions out there that you're aware of, or is this when Mr. Wilson talks about other things that are followed, and are these various Rule 23 orders?
I'm not sure personally, like specifically what other like rulings, I mean, but if they are published decisions, presumably they're going to be cited by other courts going forward
I didn't
until
find any, which is why I'm asking, and I should have
I'm
asked
not
Mr.
sure
Wilson.
personally, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there had been, because if they are the only cases out there and there's no other case like that goes against it, because I haven't seen an argument made that this somehow takes away the constitutionally protected independence of counsel and actually could be a bad thing for defendants, and prevent them from receiving effective assistance of counsel. That's why these sort of restrictions can actually deprive a defendant of their Sixth Amendment right to effective counsel. It may not be in like this particular case that the restriction might, but I mean, in some case it will, where I'm not sure if this is case, but some case it will actually probably that the argument could be that this limitation somehow denied the defendant their Sixth Amendment right to effective counsel by forcing their attorney to make all these poor arguments. That's why I guess it's just got to be very careful. This court needs to be careful about just following Downs without considering the very strong Sixth Amendment interests of defendants and having independent counsel make judgments about winnowing out poor arguments and trying to, present their best possible case to get their client the relief they want.
I
So
asked
that's
Mr. Wilson about the 500 grams of cocaine versus the 400, which is the minimum for Class 6 felony sentencing. You heard his response. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, Your Honor, it's the situation that the rule against considering factors inherent in the crime is not to be applied rigidly. And so the courts have always been allowed to consider degrees of seriousness in within an element. So like the example could be the extent of great bodily harm. When great bodily harm is inherent in a crime, there's varying degrees of amounts of great bodily harm from just the bare minimum to more. And here there's a wide range of grams that apply in this particular crime, but also there's a very wide range in sentencing too. So it's the type of thing where the fact that there's more grams here means that this particular substance can be divided up into more doses. And the more doses that go out from this particular set of substance can mean that there is potentially a lot more harm to the community. So the extra 100 grams divided into further doses reaching potentially more people is definitely a consideration that the trial court can make, because the rule against considering inherent factors is not rigid. And it can always consider the nature and extent of elements. And so that's why the defendant's issue is his objective to this on appeal here is not well taken. And so the only thing I wanted to mention is about the right to testify at a suppression hearing. I know the defendant cites cases like about welfare benefits. Obviously, a defendant has a right to testify in support of their own case at a trial, because like the Kruger case from Colorado, and there's not a whole lot of authority on this. I couldn't find any Illinois type authority. But a defendant does not have a right to a suppression hearing, essentially, if it's a trial court, a trial counsel has a strategic decision of whether to file a suppression motion or not. So there has to be grounds for it, for example. So that because it's a matter up to the trial court whether or not to even file a suppression motion, therefore it's not a defendant's absolute right to testify over the trial court's decision at a suppression hearing. So that's why this is treated differently by most courts compared to, for example, a defendant's absolute right to testify at their own trial. So that's the distinction. There's not a lot of great authority, like for example, different jurisdiction that can be cited onto that point. But at least the state has cited a case from Colorado that said that most of the courts have ruled that defendant does not have an absolute right to testify at their own suppression hearing.
I have an absolute right to testify at any pretrial proceedings.
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of that question.
Does a defendant have an absolute right to testify if he wishes at any pretrial proceedings, as he has the right, as we know, to testify if he chooses at his trial?
Well, I haven't researched other types of pretrial proceedings other than a suppression hearing. And I think because the reasoning is that a defendant does not have a right to have an actual suppression motion, that's a matter within counsel's authority whether or not to file. So I'm not sure, like a preliminary hearing, for example, where a defendant has a statutory right for a preliminary hearing, that may be a different situation than a case where here it's up to the trial counsel whether or not to file the suppression motion in the first instance. So I think because the reason for that rule is because it's up to counsel to file a motion or not. I'm not sure about other pretrial hearings. I've not researched that question. And so I would just re request this court to affirm the convictions and sentence. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brooks. Mr. Wilson, rebuttal argument?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just one quick point about the traffic stop in this case. I understand that the state wants to rely on the officer's testimony that he saw Mr. Morey's vehicle such a far distance away that it wasn't even recorded on the officer's dash cam wide angle lens. The problem with the officer trying to discern whether Mr. Morey was following too close at that time is that it was from such a far distance that if the officer can't reliably say how close Mr. Morey was to the semi at the point when Mr. Morey was crossing right in front of the officer who was sitting in the median, I don't know how the officer can say reliably whether Mr. Morey was 6 car lengths or 19 car lengths behind the semi when he initially first saw Mr. Morey's car. So
Well,
I
counsel,
don't.
this is a matter of common experience. We're all familiar with driving in interstate highways, and from 3 blocks away, maybe even a half a mile away, I could see a car driving too close to a truck behind it. Which might very well, if I had a dash cam, that they picked up on the dash cam. Why is the trial court required to? Apparently, according to you, to reject that testimony.
Because you're absolutely correct. It is a matter of common experience. But if you made that observation and then came into court and said that car was right on the truck's bumper, and then they introduced a video showing that the car was 9 car lengths behind the truck at that same time, it does undermine the credibility of the officer who supposedly is trying to gauge all of this. That's all I'm saying regarding
At
that.
the exact same time, and aren't these questions for the trial court to resolve? In other words, if it were the exact same time, maybe the trial court would have had more questions with the credibility of the officer, the trooper, than he resolved, than the court had.
I don't think I caught the first part of that question.
How do we know it's the exact same time? It seems to me that that's one of the things that the trial court could conclude. The officer saw this before the dash cam picked it up.
And arguably, the problem with that is the court sustain the state's hearsay objections when counsel was trying to cross-examine the officer using the officer's probable cause statement that in part noted when he saw the infraction.
Well, counsel, pausing there for a moment, clearly, aren't those all correct rulings? They were all hearsay. In other words, if counsel wanted to impeach the officer with a prior inconsistent statement, there's a way to do that. It's not to offer the statement. You ask him about it. Isn't that how it works?
Well, for the purposes of something like a motion to suppress a pretrial proceeding, the Illinois rules of evidence don't apply. And so the attorney can introduce hearsay testimony without there being a sustained objection. So, and that's really the part of the error in this case. The court really didn't give the defense a fair shake to fully litigate this claim. Before my time runs out, I do want to touch on the Downs portion of the argument. I understand that when a court decides a case, they have to think about how their precedent is going to be used, what other courts are going to rely on that precedent, and how do they implement the logic they want to implement while also deciding the case that is currently pending in front of the court. I know this court from this argument has questions about Downs, but what I would point this court back to is what the court ordered in its order remanding Mr. Morey's case to the circuit court. It ordered there to be the appointment of counsel for counsel to investigate and present Mr. Morey's claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. When we got to the evidentiary hearing following that Krankel remand, after the state conceded that Morris was possibly neglectful of Mr. Morey's case, Krankel counsel elected to present absolutely none of Mr. Morey's ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Not only did counsel not follow this court's mandate, but this court or the counsel was arguably completely ineffective for not—
Wait a minute, what part of this court's mandate directed Krankel counsel to accept all arguments that the defendant wished to raise?
Well, that would be governed by Downs itself.
And that's what our mandate approved Downs? Is that what you're saying?
No, your mandate didn't approve Downs, but it did require counsel to investigate and present Mr. Morey's claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, which included a claim that this court already— may I just finish this one answer?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honors. It included a claim that this court, where this court found that trial counsel was possibly neglectful of Mr. Morey's case. That claim should have been heard, and counsel didn't raise it. And that rendered his representation not only violative of Downs, but also ineffective.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Thank you both. The case will be taken under advisement and a written decision will be issued. The court stands in recess.